any reasonable person who would not otherwise suppose to commit the law, a great law, such as absolutely overwhelming pleas to sympathy. I've got a dying mother who a doctor will give no more morphine to, as an example. Any reasonable person who had access to morphine and who was presented with certain facts might sell morphine to this person. That's why in this jurisdiction, given the fact that the focus of attention is on the conduct of the police, that it's a judge issue, because it's really a question of law and not a question of fact, because it involves conduct committed by the police and what a reasonable man would or would not have done, not what the defendant would do. This defendant is irrelevant to a consideration of entrapment under the Grossman test. And the present case law is that the judge decides it on a prior trial, whether or not the police engaged in conduct that illegally induced someone to commit a crime.
All I know about entrapment is what I learned from Wendell Kay. Besides, I tried to utilize the defense of myself one time, and it cost me $5. At some McLarbor, and I got arrested for sleigh riding, and I claimed I was entrapped because I was sitting home babysitting, and 10 o'clock at night, he showed up and knocked on my door with these flexible flyers and said, let's go sleigh riding.
And flexible flyer?
Yeah. And so out we went, and we got nailed. I claimed entrapment. You know, the pure mind, no predisposition toward this type of legal activity. When the police officer came and conned me into it, he was a judge at the time.
Court of it.
Yeah. We were fine.
Yeah. Who tried to get
you? This deputy.
For the record on the entrapment thing, we did have a provision in there that said it should be tried by the court in the absence of a jury, and in the subcommission. Then the later draft, it was suggested that that be taken out because it was obvious that that is existing law and this restates existing law. In the commentary I say this, of course, will continue to be dealt with by the judge in the absence of a jury. And if we don't put that language in the statute, I assume that commentary will stay, since that is existing law.
That's what I like.
Okay. Article 5 is the section on responsibility, and this is the insanity defense. And
where are we at?
Oh, on page 91.
No, how much more do we have to go?
Well, I got 3 more pages. And that will finish everything. I could stop now and, you know, do it when G. Ken Edwards on Tuesday.
Be a nice little warm-up for you, right? The 3 pages get you.
Sure.
I don't have to. We all get goofy after about 2 hours of this early
time. Senator, you should have seen the subcommission meetings when we had 10 hours some days.
Oh, yeah.
I was in terms of goofy it.
I think I was ruined for the day when I tried to visualize a flexible flyer with. How old were you then?
Must have been 40.
I think I was ruined for the day when I tried to visualize a flexible flyer with. How old were you then?
Must have been 40.
To the marriage side, to the next time. see if I could have a link in this, and a typing thing, and if you actually need my credit by TV, I can get it to you. I would expect to work on this over the weekend. That's my guess, yeah. I do have these examples, but you don't need to get them in all of it.
For the record, my name is Gary Stern. Just to say that. I think that a lot of the amendments that were adopted by the Committee on Failures went to specific points of women's really priorities. I would suspect that the amendments that were making now would go to those points. But it's pretty difficult to manage that. But it's definitely not the key. We left off with the weapons offenses. We were putting misconduct involving weapons in the third degree, and there were only three more crimes remaining in the statute. That's on page 75 through 77. The first one is possession of burglary tool, and that statute is new to existing law, and it prohibits the possession of a burglary tool with intent to use it or commit the use of the tool. We make that an admission, and again, that's crime of use of existing law. The next crime in the section called criminal possession of explosives prohibits the possession of explosives with intent to use that substance or device to commit a crime. One degree less than the crime that is intended. So, for example, if you intend to commit an A felony with the explosives, for example, arson in the first degree, the possession of explosives without intent to be a B felony. I know Mr. Hickey has a suggestion on that, but I'd like to just finish the last statute and then go into the suggestion. The final one is unlawful furnishing of explosives. And that's in section 150. And that prohibits furnishing explosives to a person knowing that that person intends to use that substance or device to commit a crime. We made that a three felony. All those three crimes are new to existing law. Dan is left, we like to summarize.
It seems to me that anyone who possesses explosives or intends to commit a crime is committing a fairly serious crime. It's going to be quite difficult to establish the possession of explosives as a crime. And the proposal actually suggests that if you possess an explosive, typically the first degree, and you possess an explosive, that's a simpler approach and one that generally reflects the level of conduct involved. have some problems, I guess, with that, in the sense that I see a possession of explosives with intent to commit a relatively minor offense, for example, a misdemeanor or a misdemeanor, and that would give rise to a brief felony prosecution. Now, I'm not, that's just a problem I have with the policy decision we made. I was in favor of putting it as a brief felony if you decide that explosives are just inherently dangerous to any person. And when you combine that with an intent to commit a crime, that would be done and enjoy the regardless of the level. Yeah. Well, I don't have any recommendation. I don't think it's too wrong to wait for that, but I understand it. The example that was given was actually about the criminal trespass on the tenant's property. About the law of the tree that was just pulled on to you and then it was very difficult to think that this example of perhaps making a road to someone's property in which you needed a close to the law of the stump. That's the crime of the criminal trespass, and it would aggravate something that would normally be a free misdemeanor to a few felonies because he wants to do it with doses. I see that as a potential problem.
The more music is there, the more
well, on the subcommission, the concern by the discussion was discussed, and that is why the penalty structure is based on the fine intended by the defendant. I don't think the figure could do that, but I can actually see the figure up in the room.
It was raised by the question, but I think it's about the penalty.
You have to study the law, and I think that's just a possibility. conditioned to agree that that's not going to make that operation possession of the that has not been done. I guess we can move it if you like and take one of the bills that deals with accomplished liability that we haven't touched on. But I frankly got a little tired of making sure. This deals with when a person will be liable for the conduct of another person constituting a crime. Section 100 says if you're guilty of an offense that is committed by your own conduct or the conduct of someone you are legally accountable for. And Section 110 lists the situations where a person is legally accountable. The first is when a provision of the law provides that you are legally accountable. I'm not too sure there's any provision that similar to it does this, but you could have a provision, for example, that says a borrowing or who sells to a person that's intoxicated, who knows is intoxicated, would be liable for crime, for manslaughter committed by the borrower of the alcohol. Subsection 2 deals with situations where traditional accomplice liability, and it requires that the consistent with existing case law, it requires that the accomplice act with an intent to promote the facilitate the commission of the offense. Acting with that intent, you have to solicit the commission of the offense, for example, solicitation to murder, or aid or abet the person planning or committing the offense, or failing to make an effort he's required to do that is imposed by court rule, statute, or ordinance. Section 3 deals with another form of liability for the conduct of another, and this deals with a situation where you are cause an innocent person or a person who lacks criminal responsibility to engage in the crime. And such example there would be a bank robbery where one of the robbers gets a hatchery and at some point requests him to drive the getaway car as an effective way to speed. As a result of that conduct, someone dies in an auto accident. Well, the bank robbers will have, I'm sorry, the victim, the hostage, will have the defense of the arrest and say that he is forced to do it, that is fair for the reasonable person would have engaged in that conduct. This provision would provide that the bank robbers would be guilty of manslaughter, not the hostage, but the bank robbers. Section 120 on page 2 deals with situations where a person is not legally accountable for the conduct of another. And these are been recognized in case law, although they've never been codified in Alaska. The first says that if you're the victim of an offense, you're not guilty of the offense. For example, if you are the victim of an extortion situation, you may be promoting the offense by giving the money, but this provision that you're not guilty of the conduct of extortion. Section 2 says that if your conduct is inevitably incidental to the commission of the offense, you're not guilty. That situation on this is prostitution. And if we define prostitution so that it can only be engaged in by the prostitute, this provision says that unless you have a specific provision saying that the patient is liable, the patient will not be held liable as an accomplice to the act of prostitution. Subsection 3 provides for renunciation of criminal intent. By an accomplice. And this is an affirmative defense which requires that the defendant establish it by preponderance of the evidence. It deals with a situation where you may aid or abet someone in planning the commission of the offense. The offense is eventually committed, but you may still want to avoid liability for it. You're simply going to drop out. And this deals with how you may drop out of the offense. And it requires a very strict test. It requires that you terminate the complicity prior to the offense, that you deprive its effectiveness in the commission of the offense, and you give a timely warning to law enforcement authorities, or you may
proper efforts to represent the commission to defend. That this requires an oral situation for the accomplice liability, the accomplice, in order to terminate his liability, has to give warning to the police, which probably is not going to serve very often. Subsection D deals with when Subsection D eliminates two potential defenses to accomplice liability. The first is that the accomplice hasn't been convicted of the crime. The second is that the crime could only be accomplished by a certain class of person, and you are incapable of committing the offense. For example, misconduct by a public servant, as we discussed yesterday, could only be committed by a public servant. You could have the situation where someone who is not a public servant solicits the public servant to commit misconduct. And under this section, you would be guilty of the crime of accomplice, even though you couldn't be liable for the crime individually. On page 3, we set out the requirements. We specify when an organization is guilty of an offense. And this version of the bill was changed in House Judiciary, and it significantly expanded the situations where an accomplice could be guilty of an organization to be guilty of a crime. Under subsection 1, an organization will be guilty of an offense for the conduct of its agent and is engaged in while the agent is acting within the scope of its employment and on behalf of the organization. For example, the agent requires specifically to do an act that may in fact be illegal, that would be covered within the scope of employment. At least that's the intent of the question. Subsection D deals with the situation where the act is not necessarily within the scope of its employment, but it's later ratified or adopted by the organization. Subject to 2 deals with the situation where the organization, where the agent fails to discharge specific duties imposed on organizations by law, for example, filing a corporate income tax. Subsection 140 deals with the legal accountability of an individual for organizational conduct, and essentially it says that just because you perform conduct in the name or behalf of an organization, that has no bearing on your individual criminal liability. So the organization may be liable for the conduct of its agent, but the agent may also be criminally liable. Those are the sections on liability for conduct of another person. Not exactly an exciting position, but rather important. I know Dan has a specific point. I think that's what it says, but to clarify, is that it's in the
bottom. And page 2 on the line 19, the term father, I think that's just not a term that belongs in the law, that's a reasonable answer. On section 19, on page 3 on legislation, the point really goes to the section of the section. That is an intent of the question. If a corporation hires someone to make money, that is covered. In my view, however, that the law of agency is clear, that murder is beyond the authority of what the corporation is doing, that it could by law not be in the corporate position. So it's my suggestion that in Beaver and 913, they if the board of corporation hired someone to commit a corporate murder, then it would be clearly
don't have any problems with any of the things. Mm-hmm.
I have to
Chapter 31 deals with the crimes of attempting solicitation. Seems to include the crimes of coercion, and that is words by the House of Judiciary Committee. Attempt is defined in page 3 as a person acting with intent to commit a crime, engaged in conduct of which constitutes substantial threat to committing the crime. Subsection B specifically excludes the defense of the factual and legal impossibility. And then in subsection 2, we recognize the offense to attempt that you renounce the criminal intent and prevent the commission from the next crime. We punish the attempt one level below the substance of offense, so attempt to be felony, you can be a true felony. And I think the overall effect of it is significantly upgraded in the punishment of offense from prison law. On page 4, solicitation is defined as a person acting with intent to cause another to engage in specific kind of constituting a crime, and that person solicits the other person to engage in that conduct. Which specifically excludes certain defenses to solicitation, which are very similar to the defenses we excluded in the situation of accomplice liability. For example, and I stand corrected on this because I gave a false confession. I gave the wrong rationale for Sherry's meaning. If under the section, under subsection 2, for example, the patron solicited someone to engage in prostitution, and the only act that was defined as crime was the conduct of the prostitute and not the conduct of the patron, the patron himself did not be guilty of solicitation of prostitution under subsection 3. Subsection B recognizes, again, a defense to an affirmative defense for solicitation in which the person presented the commission of the crime. In other words, you solicit someone to commit murder and you later decide for the crime is committed under circumstances manifest in a voluntary and sufficient manipulation of the criminal. You later countermand loyalty and the crime is never committed. The crime of solicitation identical to the crime, which is one level below the subject. And that again significantly upgrades the punishment of solicitation. Sections 140 and section 150 deal with some really technical problems regarding attempts and solicitation, regarding can you prosecute for attempts as well as the actual offense of the state of crime. It also deals with problems what you do when the crime itself is defined as being an attempt. Again, it's not the most sexy topic. There's a real theory that a solicitation statute could be used to perhaps suppress the exercise of First Amendment rights. And the reason specific conduct is specified there is to ensure that casual remarks regarding the need to go out and perhaps change the government, for example, is not interpreted as, you know, a request to go out and go out and bomb a building. That's the example of giving the commentary. But it always be guilty of solicitation. It's based specifically on the verbal conduct. You want to ensure proof that the person solicited is specific conduct on the and to emphasize that it had to be specific, so I'm not going to generate remarks.
I think the fact probably could be interpreted that way without that language, but I think in this area it's good to emphasize. Page 79 deals with three offenses that are called miscellaneous offenses. And I can say that the offenses clearly fit into that category. We deal here with three statutes here. One deals with giving tobacco to farmers, the other deals with interference with constitutional rights, the other one deals with child pornography. Right in the same. First one restates existing law and provides that it's a crime knowingly to get a cigarette or the tobacco to a child under it. Punishment. I think it's there's some people. Eliminate everything that's a violation and pursue it. Line 8, eliminate everything that's a violation. Interference with constitutional rights, we put two existing statutes regarding conduct by the defendant in attempting to defy the person of our constitutional rights, or the defendant's retaliation, such as an exercise of constitutional rights, or is done under color of law to defy the person of constitutional rights. There is one important point I should point out here that under existing law, this statute covers conspiracy to defy the person of the constitutional rights. The committee. The subcommittee felt that the conspiracy provision should not apply to this section and it will eliminate it. So now it only applies to conduct that actually reaches the level of attempt or actually succeeds in doing any of the conduct that's required. It doesn't apply to conspiracy. And we expect that it's missing conduct. On page 80, we have the
statute covering transportation or distribution of depictions of minors engaged in sexual acts. This statute was not in the, was never considered by the subcommittee. It was added by the House of Representatives Committee based on the bill that was in the House. And what it does, we had a statute previously that said it was trying to trying to employ people under 16 to engage in types of sexual acts. This statute says it's a crime to sell or transfer any type of magazine or newspaper or slide or negative that depicts children under 16 engaged in types of sexual acts. Dwayne and I discussed this provision, and it's a very difficult enforcement, aside from any problems, any First Amendment problems with it. Since it requires, in fact, that the status of the child depicted in under 16. I consider it a fairly important provision. I know it's upset a number of people, just the idea of having a type of extended provision. You want to protect children under 16 from engaging in sexual acts. Well, that's the reason. I mean, why do you have a crime that forget it?
We've got the whole world.
Moving on, page 80, to 81, we have some very general provisions of the code. General is not exactly what's decided. We have general purposes of the code. 1 through 4 sets out the purposes of the revision in Title 11. Very general language. Article 2 on page 81 deals with what happens when a statute, a criminal statute, is amended or repealed. Subsection 210 states that the criminal law provisions don't affect any civil rights, civil courses of action. And at section 220 essentially says that all the only conduct that constitutes an offense is conduct which is made a crime either in by statute or regulation. Article 3 sets out the classification of offenses in the code. What it does is it attempts to list the factors that are shared by offenses that are classified as A, B, and C felonies and A, and B misdemeanors. It starts out by saying all offenses are classified on the basis of their seriousness according to the type of injury caused the risk. And then we list the type of felonies and we explain what type of conduct is included within each class. Subsection B and C, find page 82, title page 83. We say that if a crime outside Title 11 doesn't have a specific penalty provision and it's called a felony, it's going to be treated as a C felony. And if it's a misdemeanor without a specific penalty provision, it'll be treated as an A misdemeanor, making a 1 year maximum for anything labeled as a misdemeanor outside Title 11. Jim, do you have any questions? The next section is justification.
The latter part of the decision, I feel it's short here, but we can detail that. We have basically 10 really important statutes in this chapter. The first is necessity, and that's section 220 of the bill on page 83. Necessity deals with the situation. Well, the best example would be you're on a lifeboat and
this is the code. I made a chart here, but it isn't a typical detailed one. We have basically 10 really important statutes in this chapter.
The first is necessity, and that's section 320 of the bill on page 83. Necessity deals with the situation, the best example would be you're in a lifeboat and there's just enough food for two people, say, and one person is thrown overboard or one person is killed and eaten, perhaps. And the question is that conduct a crime? This doesn't answer it. It simply says that there is a defense of necessity and the court shall determine the scope of it. The commission tried dealing with these problems, but just felt that it was just too, the rarity that these problems ever being raised mitigated against trying to define it within a specific statute, so we didn't even attempt it. Section 330 deals with the use of non-deadly force in self-defense, and it's important to get some familiarity with the terms we use in these provisions that follow. We use the term deadly force, non-deadly force, and force. Deadly force is defined on page 96, and deadly force is defined as force which the person uses with the intent of causing or which he knows creates a substantial risk of causing death or serious physical injury. Deadly force includes intentionally discharging a firearm in the direction of another person or in the direction which another person is believed to be. So that's your definition of deadly force. Force is defined on page 98 as any bodily impact, restraint, or confinement, or the threat of imminent bodily impact, restraint, or confinement. The term force is defined on page 98 as, oh, I'm sorry, the term non-deadly force is defined as any force short of deadly force. Then we also have a provision discussing when threats are justified. Under the code, if you say you may use non-deadly force, say in self-defense, you clearly may threaten deadly force in self-defense. Also, we say that if the code says you may use non-deadly force in self-defense, you may also threaten deadly force in self-defense so long as it is only a threat. You're not allowed to use it in those situations necessarily. You could simply threaten it. Example being, probably the best example is, under the code, you could only use non-deadly force to expel a trespasser on your land if the situation doesn't involve any harm to you or any fear of personal injury. Under that situation where you use non-deadly force, you may also threaten deadly force so long as it's only a threat. And that provision is set out in page 91 of the bill. So when we're talking about the use of non-deadly force, for example, in self-defense, we're talking about the threat to use deadly force as well. There's only two sections where this threat provision doesn't apply, and that's when a citizen is making an arrest or he is acting at the request of a peace officer making an arrest. Example is given is a citizen may arrest for a misdemeanor committed in his presence, and he may use non-deadly force in making that arrest under the draft. The House Judiciary Committee felt that under no circumstances should a citizen be allowed to threaten deadly force in making a simple misdemeanor arrest. Okay, going back to the use of non-deadly force in self-defense, we say you may always use non-deadly force to protect yourself from unlawful force. And there are three exceptions on page 83. The first is when it's mutual combat, not authorized by law. For example, just a decision to go out and fight in the street. You both commit assault. Neither of you can claim self-defense. Next situation is when the person claiming the defense of justification provokes the other person into using force. Final situation is when you were the initial aggressor. Subsection B on page 84 recognizes that even though you were the initial aggressor, you may use non-deadly force if you decide that, hey, stop, you're in a fight that's a mutual consent, for example, and all of a sudden it's been escalated and you just want to stop, and you say, hey, I stopped. The other person keeps fighting, you may then do sport and self-defense. This is a very complicated, just a thought, this is a very complicated subject. And we've attempted to deal with these situations, with all the situations in which force can be used. And this has gone through a number of drafts. And I know this has been a particular concern to specifically in law enforcement in terms of the use of force in self-defense, for example. So you have, again, be sure to interrupt me if there's anything here that seems unclear to you. And Dan, I'm sure you do the same. Deadly force in self-defense is set out on page 84, line 6. And what the code does, it says you may use deadly force on line 11 when it's necessary to defend yourself from death, serious physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault under the forcible sexual assault provisions, or robbery. And this is a change from existing law in the sense that this is based on your reasonable belief as a necessity to use self-defense. Again, it's a reasonable belief. You, in fact, may be mistaken. In fact, perhaps, you weren't in danger of serious physical injury. But as long as the belief was believed at the time, as long as the person believed at the time that it was necessary and that the jury found that that belief was reasonable at the time, the person will have a defense. And existing law says it, in fact, had to be necessary. If he was wrong, he will not have a defense. Subsection B sets out the duty to retreat prior to using deadly physical force. And what it says, prior to using deadly physical force in self-defense, you have a duty to retreat if you know you can avoid the necessity of using force by retreating. And then it says there's no duty to retreat if, number one, you're on your property and you're not the initial aggressor, or you're a peace officer or a person assisting a peace officer in making an arrest under Section 380 of the chapter. I think the fact that the peace officers have been specifically concerned about for example, carrying concealed weapons and the reasonable exercise of their official duties, for example, that it will be necessary in line 21 to add a qualifying phrase after a peace officer to somehow make it the concept that we're talking about here a peace officer acting in the official duties, not just a peace officer. In other words, the peace officer is in a fight, for example, and has nothing to do with his duties as a peace officer. We would want him to retreat. But all we're talking about here is when a peace officer is acting under his official duties. And that would be on page 84, line 21. I think that was just an oversight, frankly, from the subcommission's perspective. On page 84, section 340, we deal with the situation of when a person may come to the defense of a third person. And under existing law, I think it's just somewhat amusing to point out that you could only come to the aid of a third person when that person is your husband, wife, parent, child, master, mistress, or servant. And that dates back to 1824, that provision. Under the code, we say you can come to the aid of a third person, any third person, and you may use that degree of force that you believe that you may use that degree of force that you believe the third person would be justified in using in self-defense. So if you see the third person is being subjected to deadly physical force and he is in danger of death, for example, you may use deadly physical force in defense of him.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of things I'd like to point out here that I think involve basically within the stuff that covers the part three basic policy considerations. First of all, there's a view that's held among a number of my offices based on Alaska Supreme Court cases dealing with the defense of self-defense, that in Alaska, the present rule for self-defense is actual necessity. And that basically comes from the case of Gray v. State, which was a murder case where a police officer was killed by an individual perpetrating a robbery. It's also the case that's commonly cited as a felony murder case. Now, this this draft makes it absolutely clear that actual necessity itself is no longer the standard. That what is the standard is a reasonable belief in actual necessity. There is an argument that that's the law anyway in this jurisdiction, because it's not entirely settled. But it's a policy decision which the committee should be aware of. I thought the thing through carefully. I think that the present draft is the correct approach. Change the correct approach on that issue. But it's very difficult, and it does involve a policy decision by the legislature.
It may in fact be existing law.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Either way. The second point here is that as Barry pointed out, the way this whole section on justification is set up, the use of non-deadly force would include a threat to use deadly force. What that translates into is this. If you, Mr. Chairman, decide to poke me in the eye and start pushing me towards that wall, I can pull a gun that's loaded, and I can cock it, and I can stick it in your nose, and I can say, back off, Buster. And the difficulty with that is that it immediately escalates the situation when you're talking about private citizens. Because I'm all of a sudden presenting you with a situation where if you say, okay, I back off, and I keep coming and say, furthermore, not only back off, but get out of here. All of a sudden, I'm the aggressor, you're no longer the aggressor, I'm using deadly force, you're entitled to pull a gun and shoot me. And I think that creates a substantial problem. And the way this happened, as I understand it, is this, that police officers were legitimately concerned that in situations where they feel they are now justified in pulling a weapon, for example, they go into a open warehouse in the middle of the night that looks like it's a burglary in process, an open door, and there's some reason to believe that maybe someone's in there. A well-trained officer is going to have his gun out, he's going to be ready. He doesn't know whether there's anyone in there for sure or not. He's not threatening anybody at that point. He also wants to be able, in the event he's encountering someone, be clear that he can use that threat of deadly force, you know, without keying it into these other provisions. The House Judiciary Committee went a step further here and said that if it's okay for police officers to threaten deadly force when they can use non-deadly force, then it should be okay for all citizens. And I think that's something this committee should give some careful consideration to, because I believe that it can lead to the kind of situation I just described between you and I, where it suddenly goes step, boom, somebody's dead. The third major thing is under this last section, is justification, use of force, and defense of a third person. My view of the common law is that when you come to the assistance of a third person, you've got to be right. In other words, there's got to be that third person has. If the third person has used force to defend himself, he had to be justified. The thing we have here, as it's presently drafted, is that there's a reasonable belief that it was necessary to defend the third person, coupled with circumstances under which the person raising the offense, the defendant, reasonably believed that the third person was justified, coupled with the fact that the third person could have reasonably believed that he was justified. The problem, I think, is created in lines 26 and 27 with the phrase, under the circumstances as the person claiming the defense of justification reasonably believes them to be. That's extremely complex, to say the least. What I read that section to say is that if I come along and Senators Homan and Ziegler are in the middle of an altercation, and let's say they both have weapons, and in point of fact, before I came along, Senator Homan was the initial aggressor. He pulled the weapon. Senator Ziegler was justified in responding with his weapon, all right, using deadly force to protect himself against Senator Homan's use of deadly force. And by the time I get there, it appears that Senator Ziegler is aggressive, and I proceed to shoot Senator Ziegler. when in fact he's been defending himself legitimately. The way this section is written, that's fine. I can come along and I can blow away Senator Ziegler. And I see some difficulty with that. I don't think that there is language in the Gray case where our Supreme Court, I think, has expressed in no uncertain terms that the rules in this area should discourage the use of violence among citizens. And I think those are words that are particularly appropriate in this case. I think that we all realize that.
I do think it's a good idea to update the 18-24 statute. I think somebody ought to have a right to put it in some other way to knock down the sidewalk. Somebody else's way to knock down the sidewalk. And we're trying to help this kid here and stopping her. I think that I have a right to go to a rescue, which is done under existing law. Correct. Absolutely. You're an official and a member of the public. Should be done that. But as to point one, I think it's a good distinction between the two.
Yes, we both agree.
What I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that as points two and three, to the extent your Hindu justice doesn't address itself, he brings in proposed changes in the language after he's had a chance to confer again with Barron to see if they can come to agreement.
Yes. I'm in agreement with Dan on point two, the threat, but I think that should be only limited.
Why don't you guys agree upon the language and get it to us on point three, or you're at your difference at the point?
Yeah. This section doesn't so much involve a matter of difference between Barry and myself, because I thought we were in agreement all along. I think it's so important that I felt that we needed a reading from the committee on how to develop that.
Sure. Mr. Morton, feel free. Bring it back. As far as I'm concerned.
The third person one is the one where I'm sure Dan has. The idea of imposing strict liability here sounds good, but it could result in some fairly unintended results where the circumstances were such that you did believe someone was the aggressor. But we could bring back alternatives.
We could also use the line of an easy approach, but you could observe the line of force and put the unreasonable situation to be. In other words, instead of using the approach of the third person who's being attacked, substitute yourself for it. If you call it.
Yes.
I'm putting this very well, I don't think.
No, that's not the problem. Should I move on? The next section deals with, the next two sections deal with use of force in defense of property and premises. And this is, as you could expect, one of the most difficult areas for the subcommission. On page 85, we say that if it's any crime involving damage to premises, you may use non-deadly force. You may use deadly force when it's reasonably believed necessary to terminate what you reasonably believe to be the commission or attempted commission of arson upon a dwelling or occupied building. So if it's arson on the dwelling or building, you may use deadly force. Subsection B deals with the situation of criminal trespass upon premises. And this says that you may use non-deadly force to terminate the commission or attempted commission of criminal trespass upon premises. And if you see on line 9, it says, a person in possession or control of any premises or express or implied agent of that person. The commission did not feel that section should apply to any person. In other words, you're walking along and you see someone on someone's land and you don't own the land and you really don't have very much idea of who does and whether that person who's on the land has the legal right to be there. The commission felt that there should be some relationship between the person asserting the defense and the land. So subsection B requires that you either be essentially the owner or the leasee of it, or you're an agent of that person. And the reason we included that language, express or implied agent, was to include the situation where you have a neighbor, for example, looking over your land or something like that. Subsection C, this is probably the most difficult section. This deals with burglary. And on line 15, we use that same standard, possession or control of a dwelling or building or an express or applied agent. You may use deadly force upon another when and to the extent you reasonably believe it necessary to terminate what you reasonably believe to be a burglary occurring in the occupied dwelling or building. So if the burglary is actually occurring at the time, you may use deadly physical force if necessary to the extent you reasonably believe necessary to terminate it. And then Section 360 says if it's solely in defense of property, and we give the example of theft, concealment of merchandise, we use unauthorized use of a propelled vehicle on line 25, and that of course would come out since we don't have the crime anymore, or any degree of criminal mischief, you may use non-deadly force. Now the important thing to stress here is that these sections are only dealing with the use of force solely in defense of those premises or property. Other defenses may come in. For example, if someone is attempting, and this is the example I gave in the commentary, someone is attempting to commit criminal mischief on your airplane, for example, and you're out in the bush, and if criminal mischief is, if your airplane is tampered with it, you're not going to be able to get out of the bush, and you're in fear of starvation, or you're going to simply die there, you may use deadly physical force in self-defense. The defense then is not really defense of property, it's defense of yourself. So all these defenses really intertwine with each other. Are there any questions as to those provisions, defense of premises?
Jim, if it's on section 8, do you really think that it's desirable public policy to provide the deadly force when there's two reasonable functions coupled on one another, regardless of the fact that the arson may or may not have any impact on the safety of anybody? I wonder if that's I can understand deadly force if you're protecting somebody, but there's a reasonable expectation of protecting somebody. That section doesn't appear to relate to the reasonable expectation of any bodily harm. I have the greatest respect for the self-help rule in the common law. I'm not sure that this is a very viable concept in contemporary society.
Well, Senator, you note on line 8, we do require that it be an occupied building. We don't say occupied dwelling. I guess the commission felt that any time someone comes, you see someone faced with a gas can getting ready to set fire to someone's dwelling, that you could, I guess, presume the fact that there may be danger to a person. And also, I guess, the fear was that if you're dealing with arson, just by the very nature of the crime involving a dwelling, it could endanger other people that may not necessarily be in the dwelling itself. Under existing law, the statute says you may use deadly force to prevent any felony upon premises. So this is a narrow.
If this were construed very tightly, you could probably see somebody walking into the back of an apartment house or something. He or she is sneaking in the basement to set fire.
To the point that it doesn't have to be the actual crime, you're correct, because it does say attempted commission. And you'd have to establish it was a substantial step towards the crime. On page 86, we deal with the situation of use of force by peace officers in making an arrest or terminating an escape. Under the code, we say on line 4, you may use non-deadly force whenever you reasonably believe it necessary to make an arrest, to terminate an escape, or attempt to escape from custody, or make a lawful stop. Now, then it goes on to say when you may use deadly force. Under existing law, according to the statute at least, you may use deadly physical force to make an arrest of a felon, of a person who has committed a felony. under the code, of course, based on the officer's reasonable belief. And subsection 1 says you may use deadly physical force to arrest a person or to terminate the escape or attempted escape from custody of a person who has committed or attempted to commit a felony which involved the use of force against a person. Again, this is obviously one of the more difficult provisions. What this says is that you may not use deadly physical force unless, essentially, the felony was defined in such a manner that it involved the use of force against the person, and in fact, the police officer had some reasonable belief to think that force had been used against the person. So, for example, sexual assault in the first degree is defined as in part involving the use of force against the person, include conduct now classified as rape. Police officers seeing that conduct or a reasonable belief that it's occurred may use deadly physical force. Similarly, in a robbery situation, he would be able to. The difficulty, of course, comes when we're dealing with a burglary, for example. Under the code, unless you have some reasonable belief that the burglar has used deadly physical force against, used force against one of the occupants of the building, he may not use deadly physical force to make the arrest. However, subsections 2 and 3 are in addition to subsection 1, and I believe significantly expand existing law in terms of when to use deadly force in making an arrest or terminating an escape. Subsection 2 says you may use deadly physical force when the person has escaped or is attempting to escape from custody while in possession of a firearm on or about his person. So that says if a peace officer restrains, basically gets custody of the person, and the person flees from his custody, the officer may use deadly force to stop the person if he has reasonable belief to believe that he has possession of a firearm. It doesn't require that, number one, that it be a felon. It doesn't even require that the person be using the firearm. Simply escape plus possession of a firearm. Subsection 3 says you may use deadly physical force when the person you are seeking to arrest or terminate the escape of may otherwise endanger life or inflict serious physical injury unless arrested without delay. This did not appear in the version of the bill that was proposed by the Criminal Code Subcommission. It was added by the House Judiciary Committee because it felt that this section gives the police the necessary leeway to use deadly physical force in situations that may not come within the confines of subsections 1 and 2. Those are the situations where you can use deadly physical force in making an arrest. My own feeling is that it does expand the situation for you to use deadly physical force.
There is one point on this section that the law enforcement community asked me to bring to the committee's attention, and that is that as they read this section combined with the definition of deadly force, their use of a baton, a common piece of police equipment, a knife, in other words, in the course of making a misdemeanor arrest, for example, would conceivably be unlawful. Their view is that, and they claim that they teach police officers, trainees, that a baton needs to be used in a special way, that when you use it, it is an instrument that's capable of causing death and serious physical injury. That, and turning to the definition of deadly force in 96, that means force which the person uses with the intent of causing, or which he knows creates a substantial risk of causing death or serious physical injury. Now, they say that whenever you use it, you know that there is a substantial risk of causing death or serious physical injury. I tried to dissuade them of this, and the kind of example they use is where they arrest somebody in a fight in a bar who's intoxicated, who puts up a lot of resistance, and there's no way of getting them under control, getting them in a squad car, and all of a sudden he's fighting, and he's still committing misdemeanors. It's just an assault on the officer. There's no felonies involved, and that sort of thing. One example I gave here occurred here some months ago in Juneau, where the officer hadn't used the baton, and the man stuck as the officer was swinging. As a result of which, instead of getting struck in the shoulder, he got struck in the head, which did create some serious physical injury. I know that to be a fact. Now, I think there's two things that can be done here to improve on that. One is simply in the definition of deadly force on page 96, line 17, add the language in line 17 in the second clause, or uses under circumstances, which you know it creates a substantial risk of death. And the other is if the committee agrees that in the commentary, the code, that the baton situation be specifically addressed. And an example, you know, constructed basically, which indicates that in the usual misdemeanor arrest situation where a person is being subdued through the use of baton or mace or something like that, that does not, for purposes of Section 370, constitute the use of deadly force. And I think Barry and I discussed this briefly, and I think he basically agrees that it does not.
Yeah, I can't tell if you read that way, but the commentary reference, or I'd have to think about that language specifically here, but you don't want to, under certain circumstances, a peace officer can be using a baton in such a manner as it could qualify as deadly force if he did it with the intent to cause serious injury. We don't want to exclude that.
And I should add that I completely agree with Barry's remark that subsection A3 may otherwise endanger life or inflict serious physical injury much less without delay. It is extremely broad, and in my view, does broaden the existing law. I don't know how it can be worded.
I, of course, have a real problem deciding what that covers. That isn't covered in 1 and 2. But I guess what it does, it lets it go to the jury.
It's a lot of judgment.
Yeah, essentially, when you have a situation where the peace officer has used deadly force and it hasn't fallen within the letter of 1 and 2, it basically allows the jury to find that under the circumstances he did act reasonably and perhaps, you know, I think maybe that's the kind of provision we need here. But it is broad. Where are we talking about? Where are we?
Three? Yeah, I'm talking about may otherwise endanger.
Oh, immediately danger,
yeah,
or imminently.
Something like that. That would narrow it down.
Yeah. Well, it does say, but it does go on and say, unless arrested without delay. I think that the imminence is implied right there. I mean, we could add it to make it clearer, but I do think, you know, you can't say, well, he's going to 2 days from now, I think he's going to go out and kill someone. Chairman, should I move on? Okay. The next, of course, the provision we just dealt with peace officers. Now in Section 380, we're dealing with the situation of a private citizen that is acting pursuant to a peace officer's direction. What it says is that if you have been ordered by a peace officer to use force in making an arrest, or you've been asked to aid the officer under line 25, you may use non-deadly force when to the extent you reasonably believe it necessary to carry out the peace officer's direction, with two caveats mentioned at A and B. And on page 87, section 2, you may use deadly force only when to the extent he reasonably believes it necessary to carry out the peace officer's direction to use deadly force, again with two caveats. The reason I just referred to these as two caveats is that these were one of the technical amendments drafted by legislative affairs, and I know Dan has had some problems with this, and I'm not too sure how to resolve it, but I think it's very confusing. And, Dan, can you figure out a way to it?
No, I think the point is that this is a section that Barry and I should work on,
yeah,
and bring back to the draft.
I think the intent here is, we understand the intent, it's just that A and B is very confusing, and I just need to get a little work on it. On page 87, we deal with the situation of a private person who is making an arrest. And again, this is solely acting on his own account. What we say here is that a private person may use non-deadly force to arrest for a misdemeanor committed in his presence
as well as for any felony, regardless of whether it's committed in his presence or not. Now, when he may use deadly force is identical to the situation of the peace officer, except we don't have that general provision, may otherwise endanger life or inflict serious physical injury unless arrested without delay. So just lines 21 through 24. I should point out that the subcommission's proposal on when a citizen can use force in making an arrest, specifically when he could use deadly force, was much more limited than this provision. The House Judiciary Committee felt, though, that the citizen should have just about the same rights as the peace officer in making an arrest, and that is consistent with existing law. Under existing law, the citizen has the same arrest power as essentially the peace officer. Section 400 was a provision we put in here supposedly to make the police happy, but currently just makes them upset. And it's supposedly, it says that you may not use force to resist an unlawful or lawful arrest unless the force used by the peace officer exceeds that allowed in section 370 of this chapter. 370 of this chapter deals with the situation of use of force by a peace officer in making an arrest. You need some background for this, I think. Under common law, a citizen could use force to resist an unlawful arrest. In two Alaska Supreme Court cases, our court said a citizen cannot use force in resisting an unlawful arrest. Fight it out in the court, not in the street. Okay, so this provision says that. However, our Supreme Court also said that in some situations where there's an unlawful arrest, it may also involve a situation where the peace officer is simply beating up on the citizen, and the citizen is in fear of injury, whether death or just ordinary injury. And the court specifically said in those situations, when the peace officer used excessive force, a citizen may defend himself. And this is what this chapter what this section does. Now, the peace officers have, I believe, read it as saying, is that the police officers have interpreted this as saying that if the peace officer uses somewhat excessive force on you, you may use deadly force back. And that's certainly not the intent. The amount of force that you could use would be determined by the provisions on use of force and self-defense and deadly force. If you feel that it's necessary to make it clear in the statute, it's very easy to do. Dan probably has a recommendation on it.
I've talked it out with him, and I think it's simply a matter of adding some language at the end there, conditional clause, that makes it clear that the amount of force that can be used in response to excessive force by a police officer is the amount of force allowed under the other provisions of the chapter. And possibly take some language straight from the break, which again involves exactly that kind of situation. So I think it's a relatively simple matter.
Yeah.
It's acceptable to the police officer.
The next section, is that okay? Yeah. The next section deals with use of force by guards. And the first situation deals with the use of force by a guard in maintaining order in a correctional facility. And it says he may use non-deadly force if it's authorized by regulations adopted by the Department of Health and Social Services. And he may then use it to the extent reasonably and necessary to maintain order. Subsection B represents a fundamental change from existing law. Under existing law, a guard may not use deadly force to prevent a misdemeanant from an escape from a correctional facility. He only may use that degree of force that was justified in making the initial arrest. Under the code, we say all escapes from a correctional facility, in that situation, a guard may use deadly force. And the purpose, of course, is to discourage escapes from correctional facilities. This was a number of people who testified at the joint hearings on the code testified at least one, and maybe another one testified against this provision. And it's obviously a fairly controversial section. I don't know if Dan has any suggestions on it.
Well, I don't know if I have a suggestion. I have a request for a suggestion and a comment. First of all, the police think it's okay, but they think that there's no reason why they should be included, because they say that
what you're saying here, 6th and C in Anchorage, as an example, with the downtown facility, that a guy is going over the wall, 6th and C. The correctional employee inside can say, halt, stop, or I'll shoot. The guy keeps going, he can blast him, deadly force. He hops over the wall. The police officer standing on the street who says, halt, stop, or I'll shoot, cannot. It should be consistent. There's no reason to distinguish between a police officer who observes the person escaping and a correctional employee who observes the person escaping. Both the police and corrections are very much in favor of this provision, and the reason they are is they say it's impossible to distinguish. If people are placed into a correctional facility in this state, they may be charged with misdemeanors, they may be charged with felonies, they may be held on extradition from another state, they may be held under federal law, any of a number of things, and unless you color code them and give them different colored shirts and everything, when they go hopping over the wall, there's no way of distinguishing between them. It's virtually open season on a prison. That's what that section says. Yeah.
All it requires, in my judgment, for a guard or a peace officer employed in a correctional facility to be justified in killing a person who's escaping by going over the wall, by shooting him in the back, is for him to say, stop, halt, or I'll shoot, and wait about that long.
And it's even further than that, because a correctional facility doesn't mean four walls, any place for the confined of the prisoners.
That's true.
One way you perhaps eliminate some of the spirit of youth.